episode of the Live Your Full Potential podcast. I'm super excited for today's episode because my first ever sport that I got properly into was cycling, and I actually ended up being a semi-pro cyclist when I was 19. But that's for another day. Today we have John Norfolk, MBE, head coach of British Cycling, former professional cyclist, motivational speaker, former assistant national sprint coach for the GB team, a world record holder or breaker. I don't know if you still hold the record, and also regularly featured in the media. John, it's such a pleasure to have you here and looking forward to chatting with you.
Yeah, me too. Looking forward to the conversation.
So I've seen a lot of athletes in my life, including myself, go from athlete to coach, but it doesn't always work out. Some people think the natural next step after being an athlete is, oh, maybe I could coach. I'm interested to know, what was the transition like for you going from athlete to coach? And what did the passion stay the same? You know, because you're still in the same arena, so to speak, but just a different vehicle.
That's right. Yeah. I think if I were to reflect back on my own transition, it felt fairly natural. I felt ready for the change, I think. As an athlete, I tried quite a few different ways of training, and it felt like I experimented a lot. And I think because I was fortunate, I can say this now, because I was fortunate enough to either miss out on performances, miss out on selections, I found myself a lot of times in my athletic career, like questioning what I was doing, what I needed to do differently. So the losses that I faced kind of forced me to think differently and forced me to try different ways of training and approaching performance. So I think from that point of view, that natural problem solving way of going around my athletic career, I think prepped me pretty well for being a coach. I think the athletes who have been in positions where they've had to solve problems and think of different ways of doing things quite often develop the skills for good coaching. Whereas athletes who have either maybe done it one way and only known one way, or athletes who have had massive physical potential and not really known how it's happened, they've just got to where they've got to, I think they're the ones who sometimes make the transition from athlete to coach. Sometimes it takes a little bit longer when you're faced with a situation. Maybe you've got four athletes in front of you who need four different things, four different plans, and they're responding four different ways. So I think what at the time were sometimes uncomfortable scenarios in where I suppose like sat on the finish line in tears, working out why did I get this fourth? Why didn't I make the cut? Why didn't I make the final? I think then that forces you to think differently and think creatively. So I think it's definitely helped me transition to being a coach, and hopefully a coach in which I can understand the athlete and adapt my coaching process to support them to perform, I think.
That's a great answer. We talk a lot in our business about asking great questions. I think that's probably what you were referring to, is someone that's not really going to be a good coach is someone that's not willing to ask questions. How could I help? And last week we interviewed Ben Hunt Davis, and he said one of the things that they did really well, even when they won gold in Olympics for rowing in Sydney, even after they won, they said, how could we have done that better? And that's what a great coach does. They ask great questions.
That's right, yeah. And really good coaches also like really listen to the answer as well. Maybe not accept the first answer. So I think unpicking what they've heard, really understanding what they've heard, to then shape what you do with that information. You're right. I think good questions, good listening.
What is your favorite part of coaching right now? And what is John Norfolk as a coach look like today? Like, obviously you're at work right now. You see your British Cycling uniform on.
Oh yeah, there we go. Yeah. Do you know what? I the bit that really still, when I drive home from work or ride home from work when the sun's shining, and I feel like I've had a really good day. I think I've been brave and kind of lent into problem solving and kind of connected with people to do that. I think untangling a complex problem or really supporting someone through a problem or scenario feels like I've really hit the mark, and I feel like I've done a good job. I think it's a balance between the performance piece and then that kind of personal, like the human involved as well. You've supported someone through a problem. So I think that bit really, I really enjoy that part of what I do. And I suppose like most roles, there's things you enjoy more than other things. But that's the bit when you've got really deep into a problem with someone and you've helped support them work the problem out for themselves. I think that's the bit that really, really still gets me.
I'd almost call that care, your level of really caring about the result and helping them solve a problem.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah. I think, I've never heard it described as that before. But yeah, I think you're right. You know when someone's in a tricky spot, don't you? Or like really wrestling with someone or kind of, yeah, a bit stuck. And to help kind of unravel that a little bit and support them in unraveling it. Yeah, it's really cool. So yeah, to care about them and the outcome. I think that's part of it, isn't it?
To use my language, I'm not sure what kind of language you use in your life, but to use my language, excuse it. But I would say it's you really give a shit.
I wondered what was coming there. Definitely. Yeah. People who out there who coach and support other people's performances, you've got to put yourself to one side for a bit and completely put yourself in the other person's situation to understand the problem and what needs to help or what might be needed to help. So I think, yeah, you've got to put yourself aside, your ego aside, and really get in there with them and care about them and the outcome. Yeah. Mm.
And working with your athletes right now, I said this off camera, just to go off on a tangent a little bit. What's so bizarre is I live in Thailand, also Dubai, but I'm currently touring the UK and I'm actually in Manchester where John is based, which is bizarre because it's the head of cycling for the UK. I find that bizarre. But right now, what exactly are you working on with your athletes?
So as the head coach, I don't directly coach athletes in my role. So I support our podium and our pathway coaches to support their athletes. Mm. And so what am I working on? We're working on kind of revisiting our like performance planning process. So what we've really tried to instill over the past few years is creating really clear, transparent plans where not only we know what we're aiming for, how we're going to get there, but also how we're going to kind of track our progression as well. So we've just been through a block of racing on the velodrome, on the track. And in a few other disciplines, we've had our first kind of events that feed into Paris Olympic qualification. So we're just at the point now where we're just kind of touching on each of the plans, what needs to change, what needs to happen differently, how we responded to what we've done so far, and then what needs to happen moving forward. So it's a little bit of a replanning process. But yeah, it feels we're in a good spot. We're in a good spot in which I think we're clear about how we want to create performance and then how we then track against that.
How do you, if you mind me asking, how do you track your performance, even if it's just some of the metrics that you use or your one, two or three metrics?
Yeah, I think, I mean, it's a blessing and a curse within cycling. We can measure a lot of things. So we've definitely fallen into the trap historically of measuring everything and trying to use everything and becoming a bit complex and not clear about what's important. So I think when you've got the opportunity to measure a lot of things, whether it's power on a bike or your aerodynamics or your position on a bike or physically what an athlete is capable of, I think what we're doing now is getting to a point where a plan really reflects the demands of an event. So if you've got a cycling event, there's a big physical component to most cycling events. There's a technical or tactical component to that. There's a kind of a delivery under pressure component. So I think when you break the event down into its component pieces, what you measure and monitor needs to reflect all pieces of that.
Yeah, it makes
sense. So in a cycling event, it's there's some areas in which they're easier to capture. So it's easier to capture how much power someone's producing on a bike. It's much easier to capture that than how someone's developing in the middle of a very kind of detailed technical plan. It doesn't mean to say it's more important, but it's just the easier thing to capture. So I think we identify all the areas of the plan which are important, and those are the bits that we track. So how someone's progressing technically, how someone's progressing physically, but really specifically to that event. So the more specific we can make it, the better. And then you boil it down to its kind of component parts. You've got two or three or four really important things rather than like 100 things.
Yeah. Keep it simple. Keep it super simple. Not keep it stupid. Yeah.
That's right.
Do you track, even if it's just with an individual athlete, do you or your coaches track mental performance and the mental state of your athletes?
It varies from discipline to discipline and coach to coach. I think there's people who track things like mood and recovery, and also how they're performing under pressure and at what stage kind of their kind of technical delivery starts to break down. They're probably some of the examples of some of the things that some of the coaches use. And they'll do that in different ways. Others will use kind of metrics and maybe a bit more of a scientific approach that others might just be really tuned into where their athletes at, what they need, and they do it through more of a kind of relational way. So it depends on the athlete group and the coach, really. I think we've got a fairly systematic way in which we go about our kind of performance planning, but we've got really different coaches in really different disciplines, and they all do it in really different ways. So we're trying to find a way that we do it the GB way of performance planning, but also kind of connecting that to individual coaches, because you know as well as anyone, every coach is different, every athlete's different, so it's got to fit the need.
Yeah, that's why I thought it was an interesting question to ask, because it's not something that you can just have a general structure for or a general for. Someone that's been a, like I mentioned before, a semi-pro cyclist, I've also been a professional martial artist. For me, more, I know from my own experience and having worked with a lot of high performers that more is not always better. So I think you were touching on that, right? Like, what's the threshold or the tipping point where we have to recognize that actually our athletes are doing too much? Is that what you were saying?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think, like you talked about keeping it simple before, really simple questions like, are we working hard enough? Are we recovering optimally? I think those are really simple questions, but really impactful ones. And sometimes quite complex ones to answer, aren't they? So I think for me, when you identify what you're kind of aiming to achieve, you then want to break it down into all its pieces to really understand what are the demands of that, what we're trying to do. And then you kind of then start to kind of chunk it up and then try and simplify it. So I think you've got to break it down before you can then simplify it.
Okay, understood. You've mentioned recovery twice. Over the last few years, at least in the public eye, it's probably been around for a long time, but recovery has become front and center of high performance. You know, you've got the Tour de France riders. I know you work. Do you work only in track or road cyclists as well?
I oversee all the disciplines. So we've got coaches who work with endurance athletes who are in the pro scene as well as on the track. Yeah.
Okay. So like Whoop straps, you know, or I know I've got a Whoop strap, but probably 4 or 5 years ago, I don't feel it was even talked about a lot. How important now in 2023, when we're filming this, is measuring sleep performance when it comes to not just achieving high performance, but sustaining?
Yeah, I mean, training is the destructive part. So that's the part you kind of break down and stress your system, isn't it? And the adaptations come in between the end of one session and then the start of the next one. So that's where the growth and the adaptation happens, isn't it? So I think what you do in that recovery space has a massive impact on the outcome of the training. You give two people exactly the same training and they recover. They have a different approach to recovery, should we say. You'll get two completely different responses, won't you, even if the sessions are exactly the same. And I think that's where thinking about the whole person as a performer, as opposed to just thinking them as just a bike rider or just a track and field athlete, I think that's where that becomes really impactful. It's how they live their lives which will determine the success of the training, not just what happens on the track, on the velodrome or in the gym. And so there's ways of kind of tracking and monitoring different elements of that, whether it be sleep, whether it be kind of like sleep quality, whether it be what they're eating, or general stresses in the life, things like, I don't know, arguments with partners.
I was just going to say family stress.
Stressful commutes or having three children in my case.
Wow.
Everything's connected. And so there's nothing in our lives which aren't connected and doesn't talk to or have an impact, positive or negative, on something else. So I think when you step back and look at the person as a whole, their lives and training being a component of that, that's then when you get a really good understanding of what you then need to do. And then also maybe what you need to track and be mindful of.
Yeah, that's a really powerful answer, especially for the average person. And when I say that, I mean, our listeners are generally people that are working really hard, but they also want to achieve their personal goals, live a holistic, successful life rather than just, you know, being a professional athlete. But I love what you shared about you can have two people doing the same workout, and the next day they can be in a completely different place based on their recovery, their sleep, their lifestyle, the choices that they make. And almost, you know, makes me want to, what people should pay attention to, not just following what their trainer or their coach says, because that could be written for someone else. But you're not looking at the other factors that actually are contributing towards your recovery. And like you said, there's so many things, so many things.
Yeah, you're right. And even that kind of like belief in or ownership of what you're doing, to have a program from a coach and you follow it and it feels like someone else's program, just simply the how much you believe in your training and believe it's the right thing for you, even that has an impact on how people respond to that training, their belief in how relevant their session is for them. So if you get the opportunity to input in your own session, or you believe it's the right thing for you to do, as opposed to going through the motions of maybe what feels like a generic program, even those scenarios would have different outcomes. So like you say, understanding and believing in what you do is really important, isn't it? And not, I suppose, not just from a purely training point of view. Lesson for life in there.
Everything. Yeah. actually, that's a perfect segue, because I want to speak about something that I refer to as skill not being enough. If your skill was enough versus psychology, if skill was enough or knowledge was enough, you could have everyone go to the velodrome, train with you, and have pretty similar outcomes. But psychology beats skill. When you look at your athletes, in a percentage, where would you say self-confidence, specifically around psychology, self-confidence plays over skill? Is it like 50-50 in your opinion? And it's just an opinion. I understand that. So you measure everything. So it's not something that.
Yeah. I think I would, yeah, you're right. So if, again, if you were to have 10 athletes and develop them in technically in the same way, the ones who will be able to execute that under pressure on the day would be the ones who'd perform the best. Some might do that naturally. Some might see a competitive environment as their place to thrive and show what they're capable of. Others might feel the pressure of getting it wrong or the expectations. And then that may have a negative impact on how they deliver those skills. So I think it's important. And for me, it comes down to the kind of planning and preparation. If you can be on the start line and know you've done everything you can to prepare physically, technically, tactically, you're in a good place and you're ready to perform, I think that's when you see a really good conversion rate from what someone's capable of to what they actually do in the event. But I think the opposite of that might be if you're on the start line and you kind of know, you know what, I could have done a little bit more here, or I haven't practiced this piece, or I haven't been in this scenario before, that's when it maybe starts to come unraveled a little bit. So I think how you, that journey of learning a skill from, learning a skill, putting it under pressure, learning to execute it in different ways, against different competition, in different environments, there's a real kind of like journey there to get to the point where you know you're confident you can nail it.
Yeah.
On a big platform in front of the world, under pressure, against your biggest opponent, and it's going to stick. So yeah, it's really cool to kind of unpack that. And I think it's an area that we're still improving in, and we're quite tuned into at the moment.
I often say that at the start line, whether it's the 100-meter sprint, as in running sprint, or track start, you can pretty much, I'm generalizing, but you can pretty much see who's confident and who's not, who's prepared and who's not, just by looking at the face.
And how people respond to that, how you, as an athlete on the start line, looking left and right, how you respond to other people looking confident. And even that changes outcomes, doesn't it? Who gets on the start line first? Who's kind of pushing the time along? Who's last to the line? Who's like owning that pre-event environment? Even that can play a role in what the outcome looks like sometimes.
To go off in a different direction, but I'm interested to know, as a road cyclist, man, there was a lot of pressure. But as a track cyclist and having watched it for many years, and I actually rode a bit of track, I broke my collarbone on the track, actually. As I was pulling out, as the peloton was coming, or the group was coming around, I pulled up on my left pedal, came out, smacked the handlebars, and you know the rest probably. But the pressure must have been insane. Like, how was it for you when you were breaking records, being in the GB team? What was the pressure like for you when you were in the arena, so to speak? And how did you deal with it?
It's a long time now. I'm going to go back in my filing cabinet. let me see. How did I? I think for me personally, I was I saw my cycling career as like a really, really exciting journey. I think when you talk to some people, I watched the Michael Jordan film last night around the kind of Nike sponsorship bit and about the belief he had he was going to be the best basketball player in the world before he'd even nailed his first kind of NBA game. I wasn't like that as an athlete. I felt I was a good athlete, and I performed, and I thought, oh, okay, I've done okay then. I'll take another step forward. Perhaps I can do a little bit more. Perhaps I can be a little bit better at this. It felt like a one step ahead of each other approach, as opposed to one day I will be Olympic champion. This is how I'm going to make that work. And so I think as a consequence, every time I got on the line, I felt a bit of pressure of this might be my last opportunity to compete on this stage. So let's make it count. And I think it was to make it count from a performance point of view. So I felt the pressure to perform, but I also wanted to like enjoy the experience as well. Like being on the start line with a packed stadium, everyone's shouting, and now's your time to do your thing. That's really, it's like equally as exciting as it is terrifying, isn't it? And so I think those two things kind of seem to balance each other out. Yeah, do you know what? When you don't win, you are going to be gutted and disappointed. And I've cried outside more velodromes than I care to recall on this call, a few, because of being disappointed in the result. But the experiences I've had, where I've been, who I've met, the journey I've been on, the fact that I'm on the call here with you today is like, I'm really proud of what I tried to do and what I did do. And so I think the pressure for me was balanced in, wow, this is an amazing experience, as well as, shit, I've got to do this now. And it's now, it's not tomorrow, it's not this afternoon, it's now. And I think I just used to revert to process. So what's the next thing I need to do? To get my shoes on, get on the start line, have a deep breath. And if it was a four lap race, you've concentrated on that first pedal rev and the first corner, and you sit down. It's the process, that kind of flow state that people talk about. You've nailed that process so often that the fact that it's in front of a big stadium versus an empty training stadium, the process is exactly the same. So that's the bit that used to kind of allow me to kind of perform to what I was capable of doing.
And actually, taken from performance psychology and sports psychology, if you're prepared, to go back to what you shared before about preparation, it actually removes that anxiety. Or otherwise, if you're not prepared, whether it's mentally or physically, then you regress and you start going, oh, what's next? Is it my shoes? Is it my helmet? I can't remember. So yeah, preparation, once again, so incredibly key, so that you're autonomous and you just...
I think it gives your brain a good like pattern to focus on as well. What you can't do is sit there and then and just simply not think about something. You've got to then think about something else. Mm-hmm. So the fact that you've got a good routine, it's well drilled, and that's what's going to give you the best chance to perform. The fact that there's a massive crowd there, you appreciate and you know that you can't pretend it's not there, but you've still got a way of kind of sticking to the plan. So I think that was really helpful for me. And I found it helpful in other scenarios as well, where you can maybe get distracted or pulled off course. You kind of stick to what's important and what's the plan.
Obviously, you're at the top of the spectrum, working with national athletes, performing internationally, Olympic athletes, etc. But to the average person, when it comes to physical high performance or physical performance, can you share your view on consistency over intensity? Like, for example, I often share You know, people want to go to the gym. They want to do a 12-week transformation. They want to do an intense, rapid transformation to get in shape, get fit, get healthy, get lean. But I always say that consistency trumps that every time. Like, yes, athletes go to training camps, immersion camps, etc. But actually, it's what they do every single day that's going to determine their results. Can you share a little bit on your opinion around consistency and the importance of, even if you don't want to show up, just go for a spin?
I think you're right. I think there's a big argument for consistency. The big challenge with consistency is for me making sure you're doing something that you actually enjoy doing. It's a challenge when being consistent in something which you generally don't like doing. so like you said, I think you said at the end, like getting out and getting for a walk or something, if walking in the fresh air in a field is what you enjoy doing more than, I don't know, joining a gym and running on a treadmill, I'd do what you enjoy doing. You've got a better chance of being consistent at that point. You've got all the feel good elements of exercise as well. It's not only the stress that you put your body under, but the fact that you're happy in doing what you're doing and you feel like you've spent, if it's an hour of exercise, you'd go back and do that hour again. You don't feel like you've sacrificed an hour on a cross trainer staring at a TV in a gym, if that's not the thing for you. So I think find something that you love doing, a format or a way of exercising or being healthy that's right for you, and that'll be the best chance to kind of unlock that consistency. Really? So I'll share something with you. I do a little bit of yoga in the mornings, okay? I'm not very good. I definitely put myself in the average bracket, okay? But I can do it. I've got three kids, I've got a busy life and a busy job, but I can do 5 minutes of yoga in the morning every day. Mm-hmm. What I can't do is go out on my bike for 2 hours every morning. I would love to do that. Maybe one day I'll get back to that, but I know I can do 5 minutes a day of yoga, and whatever my day's like, if I've done that in the morning, I feel different to when I haven't done it. So even, I think going back to what you said as part of your question, even if it's the most simplest basic thing, you're doing something that's for yourself consistently over a long period of time, you're going to be in a good spot, and you're going to be able to protect yourself from the ups and downs that life throws at us, aren't you?
I'm convinced that if people did, I do 50 minutes of yoga, non-negotiable. I'm traveling the UK.
Show off.
No. It's a practice that takes 50 minutes. Yeah. But John, I've been doing it for 10 years and I'm in good shape. I'm convinced that if people just did, whether it's 5 or 10, 50 minutes of yoga, they'd be in great shape. People make it way more complicated than it needs to be. But absolutely, I totally resonate. I'd be on my bike for 2 to 3 hours.
We'll have to make it happen, yeah.
Yeah, and I live in Phuket, Thailand. I don't know if you've ever been, but the most amazing roads and hills for cycling.
Well, we do this episode in Manchester. How about we do the next one in Thailand? How's
amazing. Deal. We're good face to face. I've got my creative director there. We can put mics on the bikes and do it with a scooter in front of us. That would be pretty
brilliant. Cool. Sounds good.
So, thank you for that answer. Really great answer for everyone listening in our audience. What I usually refer to is align what you do to your values, your highest values, because we're always least motivated to do what's low on our values and most motivated to do what's high on our values. And the cool thing about this is, if I can just share something with you before I ask my next question, is if you don't feel like, let's just say, exercising, because everyone can relate, but one of your highest values is vitality, just by connecting it to your values and it's raining outside, you're going to be like, fuck it, I'm just going to go do it because I don't want to do it, but actually it's going to give me more vitality. So aligning your fitness to your highest values is very powerful.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I think the further away what you do is from your values, the harder work it's going to be either doing that or being consistent with that.
Totally.
You're right.
Yeah. Weird question, but it came to me in preparing for this interview, or for this conversation rather than an interview. In your opinion, what is the biggest limiting factor towards athletes achieving their full potential?
That's a great question.
Okay. Yay me.
I've just got to match it with a great answer now, haven't I? What's the biggest limiting factor? Yeah, I don't know whether it's because of what we spoke about earlier on, that kind of consistency piece sticks in my mind. I definitely know athletes who have stuck at it and kind of broken through where they thought they were, what they were capable of doing, and tried different ways of doing it. And I think connected with that is like being, I don't know whether it's kind of being brave or like fully committing to something. I think a lot of people potentially, and I was guilty of this, deciding what the outcome's going to be before you actually get in there and try it. So deciding that, okay, I'm probably not going to be the best at this event, or I'm probably not going to break into the national team, or I'm probably not going to be able to finish that 5K. Don't decide on the outcome until you've kind of committed to the plan and got a fair way into the plan to kind of give yourself the confidence you can do it. So I think a little bit it comes maybe down to that mindset of don't wait until you feel really good and ready to start something. You just start something and then that's the way you feel better and feel good. And so I think for me, when high performing athletes get stuck, and they often do, and you see it at the first training session they ever do, and then the final run into an Olympic Games, athletes sit there and go, I've not got this right. I need to, and they start beating themselves up. It's the ones who can just dust themselves off and just get on with doing the next step in the plan. But then to kind of help answer the question or get them out of the sticking point. And where others might just go, do you know what, this is too hard, or it's not going to work. So I think that just kind of relentless approach to moving forward, I think. I might have given you three answers in one there.
Well, no, it's a really great answer. Thank you. The reason why I said it was a weird answer is because it's so broad. But for that reason, I was like, actually, I want to ask this, because he could say, oh, it's having a coach. He could say it's not taking care of yourself, you know, self-care. There could just be so many different answers. But we're all about consistency here at our company. So I'm very happy that you spoke about that. And this is the second time you've touched on just take the next step. And I have a mantra. It's not my words. I've probably taken it somewhere from a meme. But if you're waiting for the right circumstance or the right time to go after what you want, you'll be waiting for the rest of your life. Do whatever you can.
Yeah, I think you're right. I worked here for a block of time in the early 2000s, and I went to Australia for 2 years, and then came back again in the similar kind of roles. And I used to say to people, I said, you create your own opportunities here, whether you're an athlete or a member of staff, you create your own opportunities. And what you do, the effort you put in, and the fact that you'd still move forward and try something and push in a certain area, you create your own opportunities. Like you say, there's a reason why some people are luckier than other people. And some of it is just luck, isn't it? Other people do well at making their own luck, don't they? By trying things and working things out. So I think, yeah. I agree with you. I think you've got to do something to get something, as opposed to wait to get something before you then do something. That wouldn't make a good meme, would it?
Do you know that saying, what is it? The definition of luck is when hard work meets opportunity.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right there.
Opinions of others. Let me just get the question right. In your opinion, how important is following your inner voice versus the opinions of others around what you're doing? Essentially, trusting your own intuition in your decision-making.
I think a little bit about this these days. I think your opinion on what you feel about something will be based on your perspective of the world and the experiences you've had. So if you look at a situation, I think we need to turn left here. There'll be a reason for that. It might be that you turned left last time and it worked out. It might be you had a friend who did that. Or you might have turned right last time and it was not the way to go. So your opinion will be based on your experience, your view of the world. I think what you get from other people is their version of that as well. So you get other people's experiences and opinions. And I think when you put either a few people around a table, or even if it's just one voice, like you say, a coach's voice or a teammate's voice, to share maybe a different perspective, I think that's when you then start to get a kind of maybe a more rounded view of what might need to happen. And you start to then neutralize the kind of biases. So I'll be biased by my experiences. I'll have done something years ago which has worked, and I'll think that's the way that everyone should do it. That might just be what worked for me a couple of years ago. So I think, and I'll be biased by what's worked for me and what's not worked for me. And you'll have biases and preferences and things. So I think when you start to accumulate those around a problem, that's when you start to kind of maybe neutralize the bias. To maybe get a good idea of maybe what you need to do moving forward. And it might be your gut's telling you to do one thing, but maybe you need to do the other thing. So I think, again, it's listening to yourself first, which I think is a key bit of your question, but then creating a space to really listen to other people around you as to what you might need to do to move forward.
The reason I asked you that question is because we often say, trust your intuition first, or your gut, or your heart, whatever you want to call it. And then number two, be open to feedback and feed forward from others, but make sure that the people you are listening to are actually where you want to go in your life. Because a lot of people want to give opinions, but not all opinions matter.
That's true. Yeah, you're right. Some people have earned the right to share their opinion with you based on your relationship with them and what kind of people they are. And others, with the old internet explosion, don't we? Everyone's got an opinion on something, and some of those are more relevant than others, aren't they?
Such great questions, answers, and a great conversation. I'd love to ask you two more questions. One, I can't remember if you shared this in the conversation when we were recording or before, but I really love that you said, I'm just enjoying being a coach right now. And I think that's very inspiring, because a lot of people that I work with are so forward focused, almost obsessed, that I almost find it endearing to just enjoy what you're doing. But I'd love to know, because I think it is important in every business, career, life to have a vision. What is the vision for your career or life as a coach?
Good question. I haven't got like a career plan, if you like. I think I've enjoyed the journey that I've been on through my coaching. I feel massively privileged. If someone were to say to me at school, this is what I would be doing as a job, I'd have just laughed at them.
When did you start cycling? Sorry to interrupt.
Sorry?
When did you start cycling?
I'm from a cycling, my dad used to cycle, and we're from a kind of cycling family. So we've done it from fairly young. I did everything else other than cycling for a bit. But yeah, I've done... Yeah, I played rugby and some cross country running and some other bits and bobs as well. But always, cycling's never been far from my life. So I think if I'm kind of growing and learning and enjoying what I'm doing and feeling that I'm moving forward, I think that's as big a plan as I've got at the moment, if I'm honest. I'm enjoying what I'm doing now, and I'm looking forward to the next Olympic Games and seeing what we can do there. And yeah, let's see what opportunities.
Well, I wish you guys all the best, man. And I'll have to start following it more, because I've been off cycling for a while with a lot of transitions in my life. I was actually end-to-end challenge 3 years ago. What's it called? North to South?
The John O'Groats to Land's End.
John O'Groats to Land's End. On the eighth day, I was hit by a car and had both of my legs broken. So
ouch.
I'm just getting back into cycling now. But final question. And even if you don't know, just take a guess. You always ask this question. What do the words spiritual fitness mean to you?
Spiritual fitness. For me, I would say that would be kind of waking up in the morning, feeling like you're in a good place. Body's in a good spot. And kind of head's clear. And you're ready for a good day.
I'll give that one a tick and approval. That's definitely being happy with your life and being excited and enthusiastic to get out of bed. Great answer. Once again, great conversation. John Norfolk, MBE, ladies and gentlemen, make sure you give him a follow on LinkedIn. John, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And once again, thanks to Matt the Machine Grady for making this happen.
Brilliant. John, really enjoyed that. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.